fear on Long Island today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The MS-13 street gang is terrorizing parts of Long Island, and no one wants to talk about it, especially to TV reporters.
I have never felt so much fear. It has never been so hard to convince people to be on camera.
Plus, there are some matters that make some people really uncomfortable in France.
When you are a person of color in France, you better avoid issues related to race.
Also, an Afghan reporter returns to Helmand province and finds families and their homes caught in the crossfire.
By the Taliban from the one side, by the government from the eastern side, and then bombed by the Americans from the sky.
Those stories, plus why Britain is betting big on offshore wind power, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It is good to have you here. We begin today spotlighting two stories about immigration. One is about kids who travel to the U.S. alone, unaccompanied minors, legally speaking. We'll hear from one young woman who traveled from Central America to the U.S. without her family and undocumented.
It was difficult. I tried twice, and the first time I feel like very frustrated because I want to see my mom, and Mexico took me and then sent me back to El Salvador.
I speak with both Laura and her mother, Anna, in a few minutes. First, though, a different sort of immigration story. Let's remember that many unaccompanied minors who come to the U.S. are fleeing gangs in Central America, only to have gang leaders waiting for them once they get here to the U.S. It's a big problem on Long Island, where the street gang MS-13 has been linked to 25 gruesome killings and where the gang often targets immigrants. Local and national officials have tried to crack down on MS-13, but their efforts often misfire, as producer Marcela Gaviria explains in tonight's episode of Frontline, which focuses on MS-13 and Long Island.
When they recruit young kids to become part of the gang, you've got to actually commit a murder. And often it happens on the 13th of the month. Today being February 13th, law enforcement officials would be on high alert.
One of the most shocking episodes you recount in the doc dates from September 2016. Two teenage girls, Kayla Cuevas and Nisa Mickens, were murdered. But, I mean, murder doesn't really begin to suggest the brutality of that crime, does it?
No, not at all. It is pretty insane what they've done. And actually, the murder of Kayla Cuevas and Nisa Mickens is the one that registers with everybody because, of course, in the State of the Union address, President Trump invited the parents of these two girls.
Right.
But most of the victims are actually immigrant families, and less publicized episodes of violence where, for instance, in April, four young teenagers were killed in the same fashion by allegedly MS-13 members.
So the Department of Homeland Security launched a major operation targeting MS-13 last summer. Tell us about that.
They called it Operation Matador, and Matador was used because the bull's horn is a favorite sort of logo of MS-13. What ICE did was they ended up partnering with local police on Long Island. They went after 400 people. The story we tell in the gang crackdown is really how a community really panicked. They were so overwhelmed by the number of kids that were in their schools that were kind of at recruitment age for MS-13 inside the schools.
Yeah. So then you tell the story of one of these kids who is suspected as being a gang, a kid named Junior. He fled the gangs in Honduras, came across the border on his own at the age of 13. He thinks he's left the gangs behind in Honduras, but he hasn't actually. Here's a man named Arnold. He is Junior's dad's employer, and he's got this description about Junior's neighborhood.
Right down the street from where he lives, there's a laundromat, and these gang members were hanging out, so his son didn't even want to go out of the house. He says, these people are threatening me and telling me that if you don't, come with us and do what we want you to do, we're going to hurt you, we're going to hurt your family, we're going to hurt your father.
All right, so Marcela, just to be clear, Arnold is describing a neighborhood on Long Island, right?
That is the amazing part of it. I mean, these are sort of bucolic, lovely towns next to the ocean. And of course, there's been a very large influx of immigrants there. And a lot of these kids come to reunite with families that are working three shifts a day. They don't have a lot of supervision, so obviously they could be recruited quite easily.
So picking up on Junior's story again, he ends up getting suspended from school for allegedly making an MS-13 drawing in his notebook and threatening another student, charges he denies. Here is Arnold again, that's Junior's dad's boss, and he's describing what happened when Huntington High School authorities summoned Junior's dad to a hearing.
They said, look, we want to keep this kind of simple. He's been accused of making signs of MS-13. Just sign the paper, and we're going to suspend Junior. And if he wants to come back to school, he can come back to school next year, 2018. And George, he signed the paper. And as soon as he signed the paper, it was just a snowball going downhill.
Wow. So George is Junior's dad. Junior was held for months, right, without a hearing or being able to post bond, and he's sent across the country to a juvenile detention center. And actually, let me introduce Phil DeGrange of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Here he's describing Junior's ordeal at the age of 15 in that detention center.
In Virginia, he was kept in solitary confinement, you know, where all he had in his cell was a bed, a toilet, and no window. It was really a traumatizing experience for him. This is a kid who has never been arrested, never been charged with a crime. There's no allegation that he committed a crime, but nonetheless, he's been in detention for 4 months.
So we're not going to tell you what happened to Junior because it's a crucial pivot point in the documentary, which, again, is on PBS tonight. But you stuck with Junior and his family. You followed their story for more than a year. It's interesting. You emigrated yourself from Colombia, Marcela. What did that do to your perspective as you made this film?
Well, I understand the immigrant journey. Of course, I'm also somebody that has covered law enforcement. I've covered drug cartels. And, you know, MS-13 isn't something you want to mess with. And frankly, I think law enforcement should be quite vigilant about this group. They've committed horrible crimes. And these kids are ripe for recruitment. What was interesting to me was trying to get people's narratives and stories. I have never felt so much fear. It has never been so hard to convince people to be on camera, and it took a lot of bravery. I mean, Junior had a lot at stake in participating and a lot to lose, and he said, I want to tell my story. People deserve to know what happened.
What surprised you as somebody who's covered law enforcement? What surprised you the most as you produced this film?
Well, it was interesting to see these folks that work such insane hours and just how uncomfortable they feel with all the vitriol and how this administration has made them more afraid of coming forward to talk to the police because they're more afraid than ever of being deported. Law enforcement is in a very tricky situation. They want to get the people to help them solve these crimes. And yet the people that have the information are afraid of the police.
Producer Marcela Gaviria, her Frontline documentary, The Gang Crackdown, airs tonight on PBS. Marcela, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, and I hope everyone tunes in.
Once they make their way to the U.S., it's easier for unaccompanied minors to avoid street gangs if they have some source of support, especially at school. That's been a key for Lauda. She's a teenager in Oakland, California, and we're only using her first name here. Lauda made her way across the border, unaccompanied, in 2015 to join her undocumented mother, Anna, who's been in the U.S. since 2007. Lauda's two brothers soon followed. The teens enrolled in the Oakland International School, where one out of every four students is a recently arrived unaccompanied minor. The family received help from Lauren Markham, an administrator at the school. You'll hear from all three of them now, Lauda, Anna, and Lauren, starting with Lauda, describing what it was like to finally cross the U.S. border after a six-week journey without her family.
When the pickup arrived to take us, I saw the migration. They were running for us to catch us. But we run to the pickup and then we left.
Anna, as a mother, what was that like for you, knowing your daughter was somewhere in the desert being guided around by the smuggler?
I'm scared. I'm scared because I don't know what happened next.
I was all the time nervous and I can't sleep too. I don't know about her for a long time. And I don't know if she eat or sleep well. Sometimes they can communicate by phone, but was really a little bit, not too much time to say hi, just that. And you say, what happened? You can ask to her, where are you? Or exactly, give me your position, or what is the next step, or something like that. Because they just a little call and that's it.
So your two brothers also made the journey several years later. What was their trip like?
I feel bad for them because they were younger than me, and I don't know how they handle that situation.
Lauren Markham, I'm curious to know what details you find important in the story of the two brothers' journey.
One day at school, Anna came to drop off Laura, and she came up to me very panicked and said, my sons, they've been apprehended by the immigration authorities and they're stuck in detention and I can't get them out. I don't know what to do to get them out. It's been months. I'm doing everything right. I've given them all of my information, all of my paperwork. And keep in mind that Anna's undocumented. And so that's a very vulnerable thing to give over her information to the government. But the way that the system works is that these young people are put into youth detention centers. And those kids were in there for several months. And Anna was doing everything she could to get them out. And she was totally panicked.
The difficult part is I have an autistic child. He is a little different, but he was scared. And I said, oh my God, I don't have papers. I want to save their lives. Oh, I don't know. But I was very, very, very nervous and crazy those days.
And recently, when you could not attend court with your children when they asked for asylum, Lauren, you accompanied the three kids. Can you just tell us what that was like? What did you see?
Kids are put into deportation proceedings and they're not provided lawyers. And so these three young people had to go to court in San Francisco by themselves. And because their mom is undocumented, it's unadvisable that the mom goes into court because she could be arrested or detained then and there. So I went with them to court and they were so nervous, particularly Angel, who's the second oldest, who is autistic. It was very challenging for him to understand what was happening and just kind of like nervousness was overtaking everybody, but particularly him. His whole body was clenched. He was just terrified. And I can say part of the basis of their asylum claim is just the danger, not just in their country, in El Salvador, which is, you know, one of the most dangerous places in the world right now, but also particularly in their neighborhood. I mean, they heard a massacre right outside of their door and were terrified to go outside for weeks because they had heard people being murdered right outside their house.
Laura, let me ask you a question. You spent all that time in the desert getting to this country. Do you regret any of this? I mean, was it all worth the risk, especially given the political climate in the U.S. today?
This was a good decision that I took. Now I feel better. I'm with my mom. Now I feel safe and I learn new things. And I see my mom again. That makes me happy.
Yeah. Tell me about that. When you first saw your mom, what was it like to see her again?
I don't have words to express how I feel in that moment. That's very beautiful. I wanted to hug her and cry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When they came here and they told me, we can go out of the house. We can go to the school. We can be whatever we want to be. They want to study. They want to be a good person. And that is what I want for them. Be safe. Be happy. That is my hope.
Laura and her mother, Anna, were born in El Salvador and now live in Oakland, California. They've had help from Lauren Markham with the Oakland International School. Markham is also the author of The Far Away Brothers, Two Young Migrants, and The Making of an American Life. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Three scenes from the war in Syria. One, reports are emerging from Syria that several Russians were killed in a battle involving U.S. forces last week. That battle also involved Russian-backed forces attacking groups allied with the U.S. Two, over the weekend elsewhere in Syria, Israel carried out airstrikes against what it called Iranian targets after an Israeli F-16 was shot down. Three, on the same day, Syrian Kurdish forces fighting invading Turkish troops shot down a Turkish helicopter. That's three actual or potential conflicts on top of Syria's own seven-year-old civil war and the fight against ISIS. What's it all mean? Borzu Dargahi co-wrote a piece for BuzzFeed News titled "Syria's Civil War is Ending, but the War for Syria is Just Beginning." He says none of the parties have the same goals.
No one is pursuing an interest that coincides with the other parties. You have the Kurds who are trying to establish a sort of proto-state, an autonomous region. You have the Turks that are trying to deny them that and establish a kind of safe zone for Turkey's Syrian rebel allies. You have the U.S. that's, on the one hand, you know, putting the finishing touches on the war against ISIS, but on the other hand, according to many Western diplomats, also trying to set up a kind of staging ground to prevent Iranian influence from expanding. You have Israel, which wants to keep the kind of modus vivendi that was established on its northern border after the 2006 war with Hezbollah, wants to keep that in place. And you have Iran that wants to, you know, place a new challenge against Israel on its northern border. And so no one is pursuing the same goal. Everyone is just sort of pursuing their naked self-interests without consideration. I think the least consideration is for the lives of the Syrian civilians who are having to bear the brunt of this game of thrones, so to speak.
As you walk us through this, Borzu, it feels like there's a flow chart here of this war, and all the scenarios go in different directions, and none are peaceful.
I mean, I think that if we had a different set of leaders in the world right now, they would sort of recognize that there is a real dangerous powder keg in this part of the world, and they would sit down with each other, even groups that don't like each other, and hash out some kind of way that they could tolerate each other's goals or come to some kind of understanding that would avoid violence and warfare as being the primary tools of establishing political reality. But I think that if you look at the players that are involved, there's just no kind of reasonable people who are willing to understand the stakes that are involved and the dangers that are involved. Instead, they're just kind of nakedly pursuing their military ambitions on the ground.
What is the danger of a general war, Borzu, with all of this in the background?
I don't want to overstate it. I think that there are still diplomatic mechanisms. For example, the first call that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made after this the downing of an F-16 and then more subsequent airstrikes, first call he made was to Vladimir Putin, which listeners know has excellent relations with Iran. So I'm sure that messages were passed back and forth through the Kremlin, even though Israel and Iran don't have any diplomatic relations. So there are diplomatic back channels to prevent an escalation, to communicate intents and so on. But is that enough to prevent an escalation? What we saw on Saturday with this, you know, rapid fire escalation in terms of two downed foreign planes inside Syria, three if you count the downing of a helicopter by Kurdish rebels in northern Syria, a Turkish helicopter. What we saw was, you know, this sort of unbridled escalation that could be really dangerous, even though there are, of course, diplomatic channels. There's still the UN. There's still the very real and very important fact that I don't think that any of these parties that are involved in Syria could afford a real big war politically, domestically. I don't think Netanyahu wants that right now. Doesn't want Hezbollah rockets raining down on northern Israel. I don't think that Iran wants a war with its domestic troubles. And I don't think that Turkey wants a real war with, for example, with the Syrian regime or to get into a clash with the U.S. or something. So I don't think anyone wants that. But, you know, these things often happen even when people don't want them.
Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. The fight against ISIS in Syria isn't in the headlines much these days. That's mainly because the so-called Islamic State has lost much of the territory it once controlled in both Iraq and Syria. But there's concern that ISIS is regrouping as its foreign fighters scatter. Their movements are being tracked by a New York risk consultancy, the Soufan Group. It's run by former FBI official Ali Soufan.
Many thousands from many different places around the world joined the conflict zone in Iraq and Syria. A lot of these people were killed, frankly. Some were captured, others were able to escape. And we have counted at least 5,600 individuals who have returned home to the country of their residence. And that's a big, significant number that can put some pressure on law enforcement and intelligence services, especially in European countries.
Of course, the worry now is that these foreign fighters, whether they've run to Damascus or are lying low in Turkey or somewhere else, they're going to carry out lone wolf attacks. Is that a concern right now? And what evidence is there of that happening?
If you know you're a member of ISIS, I think, and you're committed to the idea of ISIS, unfortunately, you have ample opportunities to still carry on your jihad, either in Syria and Iraq or in different provinces that ISIS already established in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Yemen, in North Africa, in the Philippines, and so forth. ISIS now, as we predicted with our first report about ISIS, is going from being a state to an underground terrorist organization. So the physical state is no more. However, the inspirational state, the ideological power and platform that brought ISIS to life, it still exists. And we've seen that before with different terrorist groups. So Al-Qaeda, for example, after 9/11, you know, it went from being an organization with very strong command and control to shifting to being an ideology, an idea, you know, and then they send their people to be part of affiliates around the Muslim world. So Al-Qaeda was able to successfully switch from being a terrorist organization to being a terrorist message, an ideology that can inspire people. And I think ISIS today finds himself in the same position.
There were fighters from the U.S. that joined ISIS for some of the reasons you're talking about. Does the U.S. have a plan in place to prosecute ISIS fighters who return here?
I don't think we have a problem in the U.S. as much as they have in Europe. I believe that we have a very good, you know, idea of who went to join ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And the moment these individuals either are arrested on the battlefield or after they come back, they have been immediately apprehended. Also, the numbers from the U.S. are very low, frankly. For example, we had about 150 who went to the conflict zone. If you look into France, for example, they have about 2,000 people who went to the conflict zone in Iraq and Syria. So the numbers are low. Our intelligence and law enforcement services are on top of it. So to the most part, the moment they come back, they are almost immediately arrested and prosecuted for aiding and abetting ISIS.
Former FBI officer Ali Soufan heads the Soufan Group. He's been speaking with us from New York. Ali, thank you very much, as always.
Thank you very much. Always great to be with you.
I'm Marco Werman. The British government is betting big on clean energy from offshore wind turbines, and some private investors are too.
This is a low-carbon technology, but more importantly, it's a really cheap way now of generating energy.
Britain's big push for offshore wind power, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. When we hear news about climate change, it tends to be bad, right? Warmest year on record, rising sea levels, that sort of thing. So here's some good climate-related news for a change. In the last decade, the share of electricity produced in the U.S. from solar and wind power has grown 10 times to about 8% of all electricity production here. There's one source of clean wind power that we've barely begun to tap, though. Wind turbines built not on land, but offshore in the ocean. Until recently, offshore wind power has been way more expensive than most other kinds of electricity. But that's changing fast, and it's largely due to efforts in the UK. From our Livable Planet desk, Chris Bentley picks up the story in Hull, England.
There are a lot of reminders of the past in the city of Hull. Fishing boats and cavernous warehouses that recall the city's history as the hub of England's fishing industry. But today, the Port of Hull also holds a vision of the city's future.
It's a phenomenal piece of engineering, really, when you think about it.
That's Barry Dennis, a former oil man who grew up here in Hull. marveling at a row of wind turbine blades, each nearly 250 feet long, the size of a giant sequoia tree.
And actually, when you put the blade onto the turbine, it looks relatively small compared to the scale of the turbine. But when you see them on the ground, they're massive.
They're built right here, and almost entirely by hand. An earthy brown balsa wood core, sheathed in a jacket of transparent blue-green fiberglass, and finished with a coat of gleaming white paint. And Dines says they're built to last.
It's in service for 25 years in the North Sea, not the most hospitable of conditions, hence the reason why the 30 tons.
Dines now works for Siemens, the German company, which set up shop here in Hull in 2016. That was welcome news to this part of the UK, which spiraled into decline after its fishing industry crashed decades ago. Today it's getting new life from a brand new industry, offshore wind power. Not far out to sea from here, the Hornsea Wind Farm is on track to become the biggest offshore wind farm in the world, and plans are already in place to more than double its size. The size of that project is eye-popping, and many in the area are thrilled by the hundreds of jobs it's bringing. But energy analysts are more excited about another figure, the cost. The project will produce electricity far more cheaply than almost anyone imagined possible for offshore wind. Emma Pinchbeck is the executive director of the industry group Renewable UK.
We had an unofficial sweepstake, and one person got close, but not that close. And at the time we made the bet, all of us thought it was crazy.
The bet she's talking about was on the price of power from the new wind farm. The company that made the winning bid to build it is promising to sell its electricity for less than half the price of offshore wind just 2 years ago. Pinchbeck says that kind of a price drop is almost unprecedented.
You have to go to telecoms or a digital sector to find the equivalent. This is a low-carbon technology, but more importantly, it's a really cheap way now of generating energy.
The plummeting price is bringing the cost of offshore wind power much closer to electricity from wind turbines on land. It even rivals the projected cost from new natural gas-fired power plants. The industry got there faster than expected. But that was always the goal here in the UK.
Government is giving out those signals that offshore wind has a future.
Benj Sykes is with the Danish firm, formerly known as Dong Energy, now called Ørsted. They're the world's biggest developer of offshore wind, and they're the ones building the Hornsea Wind Farm. What Sykes calls signals are actually government subsidies. The UK has been pouring money into the renewable energy business for years as a way to cut carbon pollution, especially the offshore wind industry. Offshore wind has been notoriously expensive. So the idea of the subsidies was to create a big enough demand that businesses would make big investments in production, and that those, in turn, would bring down costs.
No one's going to invest in manufacturing just for one or two projects.
But with the subsidies, they are investing. Energy analysts say the country is starting to see the benefits, and that the rest of the world could, too, as the cost breakthroughs made here filter out to other countries. There are critics of the subsidies, of course. They argue the offshore wind industry in the UK has become too dependent on government support. They're also concerned about the possible impact of the turbines on marine ecosystems and the fishing industry. But many people in Hull feel proud and certain of the future they're building. Outside the Siemens warehouse, Barry Dines gazes up at a row of skyscraper-sized towers in the docks nearby, waiting to get fitted with finished turbine blades.
This facility is long-term, so it's here for 15 years to serve the industry over the long-term. And our next project is already in the pipeline. It'll be even bigger still.
For the world, Chris Bentley, Hull, England.
Chris's reporting was supported by the Heinrich Böll Foundation. Chris will also be looking at what the boom in offshore wind has meant for two down-on-their-luck English cities. That's coming up tomorrow on the show. Right now, though, we want to know what all this means for the offshore wind industry here in the U.S. And the world's Carolyn Beeler from our Livable Planet desk has been digging into that. So, Carolyn, we just got a pretty good taste of what this offshore wind business looks like in Hull in England. Generally, though, across the pond in Europe, they're way ahead of the U.S. when it comes to offshore wind. Tell us where exactly the industry here stands right now.
Yeah, so there are 94 wind farms off the coast of Europe, and there is exactly one off the coast of the United States. That's off of Block Island in Rhode Island, and it's just a tiny little pilot project. But there are more than 25 additional projects being planned here in the U.S. That includes two projects in Maryland that have already won purchasing agreements from the state, and then proposed projects off of Long Island, New Jersey, and North Carolina. It's unlikely that all of those 25-plus projects are actually going to get built, but we do seem to be at something of a turning point for the offshore wind industry here in the U.S.
So Chris's story mentioned that what's happening in the U.K. could spur investment in offshore wind elsewhere in the world. Is that happening in the U.S.?
Yeah, what's happening in Europe has been a huge contributing factor to this momentum shift here in the U.S. I spoke with Stephanie McClellan, who is the head of an effort out of the University of Delaware to promote offshore wind. And for years, she's been working with state leaders to help them figure out how to make offshore wind work for their ratepayers, their utility customers. And for years, every time she's walked into a meeting, she says she gets the same question.
What is the cost of offshore wind? Is the price going to come down? And then the next question would be, how much is it going to come down? So up and down the East Coast, every state that I've worked with, either governor's offices or legislators, that's the question.
And when individual states here are trying to answer that question, they're looking to Europe for answers. So as offshore wind prices fell over there, it started to look more and more viable here as a part of the solution for coastal states who are looking to get more of their energy from renewable sources.
I think we certainly can say that unless there was a large enough market in Europe that pulled to the market these innovations and these cost reductions, we would not be even having this conversation today about offshore wind in the United States, I don't believe.
So Stephanie McClellan there mentioned innovations and cost reductions in Europe. So we're seeing cheaper prices, but make that connection, Carolyn, from European innovation to cheap prices here. How does that work exactly?
A lot of the R&D and supply chain improvements that have gone into building the components of different turbines in Europe would translate to savings for U.S. projects. So, for example, the biggest cost savings that's come in Europe has been an increase in turbine sizes, so they can generate about twice as much energy as they could even a few years ago. Another thing is that capital, so borrowing for these types of projects, is seen as less risky than it used to be. So the cost of borrowing money has gone down, which also translates to the U.S.
So, Carolyn, if the industry, the offshore wind industry, is still in its infancy here, can we really predict how much prices will come down and what effect that'll have on the overall industry?
The industry is in its infancy, but we do have two data points that help suggest that price really is dropping here in the U.S. So that one offshore wind project that's already in the water off of Block Island, Rhode Island, the price being paid for energy there is about twice as much as the price that was contracted out for two new projects off of the coast of Maryland.
Wow.
That'll go in the water several years down the road. So the price really is dropping. To put that in context, though, those Maryland prices are still, you know, more than twice as much as energy that would come from a natural gas plant that would be built around the same time, according to projections.
Gotcha. So we're pretty close to the offshore wind power tension here in Boston, because what might have been the first big offshore wind project in the U.S. was right off the coast of Cape Cod. And a few years ago, it got canceled after powerful local residents opposed it. So how much has public opinion changed since then?
It's hard to say if or how much public opinion has changed. Actually, over the years, there's been relatively high support of offshore wind for people in coastal states. But history does tell us that vocal minorities, especially those with a lot of power, can stop these types of projects. So it's yet to be seen if that's an issue going forward. One thing that has changed is that technology has improved so that these offshore wind farms can be sited farther off coast, which might equal less public opposition from folks who live on the coast and might be seeing these turbines on the horizon.
There are still concerns, though, about what offshore wind power and turbines actually mean for marine animals, right?
Yeah, there has been a lot of research done, but we still don't know exactly what the long-term implications for marine mammals and other species are. And that's something that Chris Bentley's last story in this series, airing later this week, will get at.
Well, we'll tune in for that. Carolyn Beeler from the World's Livable Planet Desk, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
My colleagues on the fifth floor of the BBC in London are a multilingual bunch. They work in some of the 40 different languages other than English that the BBC broadcasts in, and they're always doing amazing work, which you can hear on the Fifth Floor podcast. Here's one example. Recently, the Afghan service took on a really ambitious task to assess and map the Taliban's influence across Afghanistan. That's how the BBC's Aulia Atrafi ended up in Helmand province. It's a power center for the Taliban and Atrafi's home. On the podcast, he told host David Amanur about his visit to the provincial capital of Lashkargah, where some 10,000 people have fled to escape the Taliban.
It hits you as soon as you enter. The people look as if they are from another place. They don't fit into the city because they are so poor. We met Muhammad Riza. He was one of the richest men in town. He had an orchard of pomegranates, 2,000 trees. He described it as a paradise. He said, when I used to enter my garden, you know, my spirit would be lifted. But now, he said, I don't have a blanket to sleep in. After I came and my report went on air, I was in London to present that. The next day I woke up and in my hotel, I was sat on my bed sipping coffee and looking down on London on a beautiful sunny day. And suddenly I started crying without any reason and I couldn't help it. You know, these were honorable, dignified people, and now they were in such a state. The thing is, they couldn't get used to this poverty and the misery that they were living in.
In your report, you take us to this place, this front line, but it's interesting the way that you introduce it as three front lines. You say, this is the civilians' front line, this is the Taliban's front line, and this is the soldiers' front line. It's the same place, but you're looking at it from three different perspectives. Why did you want to do that?
I think it was more to show that the, you know, the suffering on these different levels. I went to this house. It was a beautiful mud house with this brick arch, and it was hit from three sides, by the Taliban from the one side, by the government from the eastern side, and then bombed by the Americans from the sky. And there were still signs that a family was living here not long ago. And this front line, for example, all around it, for about at least a kilometer or two that we could see, everything had dried out because this was a no man's land. No one could water these plants. There were hundreds of trees, all dry, and some of the ground had taken fire and it was black. It was a very, very eerie and ghostly feeling about it.
There's a point also where you come out of one of the soldiers' armored vehicles and you say, now this is the soldiers' front line. So what was it like going behind the Afghan security forces front line?
It was scary, the, you know, the whole mentality of it. So the soldiers were telling me that now they are used to fighting so much that they get bored if there is no fighting for a while. So the Taliban were so closed on the soldiers' front line that they could hear each other. And that was good for the soldiers because they said, when we get bored and we want to fight, then we taunt the Taliban. The Taliban are calling, you know, where are you, you sons of Bush? They mean President Bush. And then the security forces call back saying, we are you sons of Punjabis. That means they are supported by Pakistan. So it's all very derogatory language. It's very, very intimate in a way. The Taliban watchtowers are houses nearby. There's a lot of banter. For them, it's as important as fighting with guns.
And who is this Afghan army commander, the one they call the Terminator?
Commander Wali, he leads the 3rd Border Police Battalion. First, he got hit in his legs by a machine gun. Then he recovers from that. Then a rocket lands in front of him. Shrapnels hit his chest and his body. He recovers from that. And then in Sangin district, a Taliban RPG hits his Humvee, the armored vehicle. That takes the back of his skull. And then an American doctor pull something out from the back of his skull, perhaps a shrapnel, and he opens his eyes and they realize he's alive. For the bit of skull that's missing, they put a metal plate there. And he goes back to work after a while. And then he walks on the Taliban landmine and he loses both of his legs. After 2 months, he's back on the front line and he's leading the same battalion, the same men that he's been leading, you know, for all the time. He's a very philosophical guy. He was the most sophisticated warrior I've met in my life. He wasn't boastful about his resilience or about his achievements, a rather modest guy. And he said, this war is imposed on us. I, he said, am fighting on the government side. My cousins are fighting on the Taliban side. We don't know what we are fighting for, why we are fighting, but we are fighting nonetheless. And the civilians and the children that are dying, I have no answer for that.
Alia Atrafi of the BBC's Afghan service, speaking there with Fifth Floor host David Amanour. When Emmanuel Macron was elected president of France last May, his victory was a clear rejection of the extreme right and its candidate, Marine Le Pen. As a relative newcomer, Macron was also seen as a breath of fresh air in French politics. And when his party went on to win a majority in parliament, it brought more political newbies to power. And yet, when it comes to talking about race, activists say they're up against the same old historic French problems with Macron's government. Rokaya Diallo is a French journalist and filmmaker. Her parents are from Senegal in the Gambia. She describes herself as an activist fighting for racial, gender, and religious equality. And last year, she came very close to being an advisor to Macron's government. So, Rokaya, thanks for being here. You were appointed to a digital advisory panel, which was supposed to help the current administration of Macron develop policy on a more inclusive digital future. But then in December, that fell apart. Can you tell us what happened?
Sure. Thank you for inviting me. Actually, I was appointed, but from the point when my appointment was made public, some people started to protest over Twitter and the internet to say that my opinions against racism, especially tackling state-sponsored racism, were not acceptable. So the government actually decided to evict me from the council because they didn't want to have protest against my positions on the space that is allowed for Muslims and also what I was saying about how the French state can produce racism.
Yeah, what had you said on Twitter? Briefly tell us that so offended people.
It was not only on Twitter, it was my interviews, the books I've written. I've said basically that there was police brutality in France and you have identity checked in the streets, you know, every day. And if you are black or Arab, you are 20 times more likely to be checked than if you belong to any other categories. And the other thing is that I am a supporter of women who wear the hijab, meaning that I don't support them wearing the hijab, but I support their choice. So my opinion is that every woman should do whatever she wants to do with her body, including wearing a hijab. And that opinion was something negative, according to the people who protested against the fact that I was appointed on this board.
So you were pushed out of that panel. What does it say to you about the French government and French society that you were pushed out and that most of the 30-member panel had your back?
Actually, yes. So the minister in charge of digital asked to the head of the council to remove me, and she did not accept. She resigned, and almost everyone in the board resigned in support of what she decided. The thing to me, it says that you said in your introduction that thanks to Emmanuel Macron, many people of color and young people were elected in the Congress. But that means to me that even if you have more popular people of color in the Congress, they are still not allowed to say whatever they want to do about race. So you're okay to be there as long as you don't, you know, you're not too vocal on race issues. And that's exactly what happened to me. I was not allowed to say everything I wanted to say on race because it's still a taboo in France.
Explain that to us, because I don't even quite understand what it means that the French government forbids talking about race.
I think that France still sees itself as a white country. So we're not really used to speak about race. And it's not an issue that people are really comfortable talking about because they tend to think that we are all French, either you're French or you're not. And among French people, they try not to make difference. But I'm constantly being asked where I'm from, how come I speak such a good French, and trying to say that openly is like, oh no, you're bringing an issue that doesn't belong to France. It's, you know, racism is in the US, it's elsewhere, but here in France, we are so universal, there are no such issues.
So, Rokaya, you made a documentary about French and American anti-racism activism, literally translating from the French. The doc was called From Paris to Ferguson, Guilty of Being Black, though in English it's titled Not Your Mama's Movement. What are a couple of things that activists in France and the U.S. can learn from each other?
The thing I really think that France could learn from the U.S. is the way U.S. has handled a way of speaking about race. You know, you have vocabulary, you have words, you have departments in university that are dedicated to race. That's something that doesn't exist in France. But on the other side, I think that in France, we have a way of mixing together that doesn't exist to me in the U.S. I see that groups.
You mean people of color mixing with, you know,
yes,
white
people. Yeah, white people. Yeah. It's something very common in France that I don't see that much in the U.S. And I have the feeling that there is much more segregation, spatial segregation, but also in friendships, in couples, you know, people seem separated to me. So that's something that seems much easier in France and maybe something that the Americans could learn from France.
I want to end with a story that's in the news that's related to all of this, and that is Minel Ibtissem, a young woman who was a huge success on the French edition of the TV show The Voice. She sang Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen in French, and Arabic got almost a million hits on YouTube. But she quit the show because there was so much public outrage about a tweet she had posted some time ago suggesting, "We don't know all the facts about the truck attack in Nice in July of 2016, and maybe the French government," she suggested, "might be silent on more details about it." So she's now off the show. Is this an example of intolerance for free speech, or did she go too far?
The thing is that Minel wears a headscarf. She's Muslim. And the first thing that outraged people was the fact that she was visibly Muslim. So they started to search on her social media because of how she looked. And the posts that she made were not on Twitter, but on her private Facebook. I don't say that it makes them good, but it's not the same thing. When you speak to your private community, you don't say the same things as when you speak publicly. And I think that many young French people believe in conspiracy theories. It's something that is, to me, that needs to be addressed, but she's not the only one. So I think that, yeah, she's been a victim of Islamophobia, because if she wasn't visibly Muslim, nobody would have even had the idea of searching into her Facebook profile.
Rokaya Diallo, a French journalist, filmmaker, and activist, thanks very much for being with us. It's great to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
So as you heard, Minel, the young French contestant of Arab and North African descent on The Voice in France, is off that show. Perhaps she'll have a rebirth. So I'll leave you with another French musical selection. This new album by the eclectic and wonderful band Lojo came out last year, and it was on my short list of some of the best recordings of 2017.
Noisy Flower.
This is my favorite track. It's called Noisy Flower. New music there from Lojo, and that's where we park it today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.